Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, the opportunity to take a close look at the theater, the arts, and today we delve into the world of music. Now, if you're a Beatles fan, I don't know who isn't, you might say, oh, I've read hundreds of books about the Beatles. And you might have. You might have read 1,000 books about the Beatles. No joke. But if you haven't read the new book called John and Paul by my guest, Ian Leslie, I'm going to argue you haven't read a book about the Beatles because this one is different. This one takes a different approach, and you need to learn all about it. Ian Leslie joining me from Great Britain at this greatest time. Ian, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Congratulations on this great book, John and Paul, A Love Story in Songs.
Thank you very much, Paul. Really nice of you to say so, and it's great to be here.
So here's what's really interesting. A lot of people, you know, they're Beatles fanatics, they write a book. Your background is one of psychology, communication. That's actually my background. And so that's what intrigued me initially. I mean, entertainment bios, with due respect, isn't your thing. What led you with your background to say, I'm getting into this?
Well, really, because I love the Beatles. I mean, it's a fan's book, first and foremost. And I think you can kind of tell that when you read it. But my background, which is, as you say, writing about human behavior, human psychology, and relationships, did really inform my approach. Because, as you know, the book really delves into the relationship between John and Paul. And I'm fascinated by the chemistry between these two guys, because I think the music and the explosion of creativity that we call the Beatles comes out of that explosive chemistry between John and Paul. And I didn't see a book that had explored that to the extent that I was interested in it. So finally, I was like, look, I know I'm not a music writer, but I do love this group and I love the story and I love these guys. I'm going to write this book. And so that's what I did.
And you've intrigued a lot of people. One more background question in a sort of a getting to write the book thing. How did you do your research? Because the kind of work you're doing in a social science sense almost seems qualitative. Did you study the lyrics of the song, watch the footage and pull? Because you get into relationship dynamics. It's your background. But how are you making that happen in this book?
Oh, I mean, there is so much information about the Beatles. First of all, as you say, there's the music, which I can just listen to again and again and always find new things. There is all the footage of them, including that incredible documentary, Get Back, from a couple of years ago. There's all the kind of studio outtakes and recordings. And then, of course, there's endless interviews and endless kind of first-hand reports and endless kind of analysis. So there's no shortage of, you know, raw material. But I thought there was I still think there's a shortage of books that help you find your way through all that material and look for the insights rather than just relating the facts. So this is a book less about what happened, because we kind of know a lot about what happened, although it does tell us what happened. You know, I do kind of give the narrative of the Beatles and I tell people who don't know much about this is what happened. But it's primarily a book about why it happened. You know, what's the wellspring of this incredible music? Where's it coming from? And I see it coming from ultimately as from this central relationship between John and Paul.
Something else brilliant. Every chapter is essentially the title of a Beatles song. And some of them are the well-known songs, She Loves You, Penny Lane, Hey Jude. But a lot of the songs are maybe not as well-known unless you're a Beatles, a real Beatles fan. But here's the thing. One would think, oh, when I read the Hey Jude chapter, I'm going to read about the creation of Hey Jude. That's not what you're doing. You're using song titles, but you're using them to step into the dynamics of the relationship between John and Paul. Brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing both, really, because you do actually learn about the circumstances of the creation of Hey Jude and how they put it together. But I'm weaving it into the story of what they were doing at the time and how they were feeling about each other. I mean, Hey Jude's a particularly kind of pivotal moment and a pivotal song, because what's going on is that they are essentially kind of splitting apart and going towards their what would become their kind of love, you know, the loves of their lives, Yoko Ono and Linda Eastman, Linda McCartney, as she would become. And so I place Hey Jude as kind of at the center of this incredibly complex kind of coming apart. And I say, you know, really, it's Paul's way of processing what's going on, you know, and it's a kind of expression of love for John, and a kind of a way of saying, you know, go out and get her. And you know, I'm going to do the same. So I don't think you can understand the songs and the music of the Beatles without understanding what's going on in this relationship at the moment.
I thought it was interesting, and I've read the book cover to cover because I grew up, my brother allowed nothing but Beatles music to be played in the house to this day. And you open the book with the death of John and Paul's reaction to it. I get why you might do it, but why did you do it? Why did you say, I'm going to start this conversation when John is killed?
Because that was almost, it was the moment when the kind of narrative of John and Paul, or John versus Paul, which is what it became, was set. You know, so in after the Beatles breakup, there's people start to take sides, you know, and the cool kids, the rock critics of the time, they all take John's side because he's the kind of stormy, difficult, cool, creative, countercultural genius.
But didn't he, I'm sorry to interrupt, but didn't he also say, look, Paul's the pretty one, I'm the genius?
Yeah, and John was amazing at selling this narrative, right? He was selling this story in interview after interview, and he did it brilliantly. And Paul kind of retreated to his farm and his kids and, you know, his wife, and said, "Right, I'm not dealing with this. And then I'm also going to make pop songs, and they're going to be big hits, and that's really going to annoy all the cool kids as well." So there's this narrative starts to evolve that John was the really real creative genius and Paul's just his sidekick, and you've got to choose one or the other. If you like poppy stuff, choose Paul. If you like really cool artistic stuff, you choose John. And then when John dies, that narrative, which was just kind of forming in the 70s, really kind of takes off and becomes, you know, the truth of the Beatles. And people started to say in the wake of John's death, you know, he becomes deified. People say, well, John was really three quarters of the Beatles, you know. And then there was Paul and a couple of others, but it's really all about John. This is crazy, right? And also this idea that Paul is sort of like emotionally shallow and is a superficial person. And when Paul said in the wake of John's, you know, when microphones are being shoved in his face 24 hours after he learned about his, you know, or less than that, after he'd learned about his friend's death, and he says, yeah, it's not great, is it? Yeah, it's a drag. And goes to his car. That phrase, it's a drag, then becomes hung around his neck for years and years and years. So I wanted to start with that moment because it seemed to kind of crystallize this John versus Paul culture war that this became. And then once you get to the end of the book, and I've told you what I think was really going on with these two and how they loved each other and how close they were and, you know, what this relationship was really like, I go back to that moment right at the end of the book, as you'll recall, and I hope that readers will see it entirely differently, all right? And they understand it from Paul's perspective, and they understand why he was so brusque and so sort of standoffish, and how kind of terrified and angry and lonely he felt at that moment, and why he just wanted to go back home and fall into the arms of his wife, which is what he did.
Brilliant to close the loop there. Let's get into sort of the things you do that nobody else really has done in these Beatles biographies. You write, these two men merged their souls, multiplied their talents. And unlike other collaborations, it's really not, and you've been saying this, it's really not about lyrics and music. You know, Simon and Garfunkel, whatever, so-and-so wrote music, so-and-so wrote lyrics. You don't, that's not what we have here. You do say there's a competition of sorts between them, but it's really an integration of efforts. They complete each other. And that's different than other songwriting teams.
Yeah, more very different to other songwriting teams. As you say, almost all songwriting teams before and after them, there's a division between words and music. That was never the case with these two. They both did words, both did music. They used to be very confusing to people when they talked to others about it. Who's the words guy? Who's the music guy? Well, we both do both. And you know, that was also unusual at the time and not anymore for songwriting partnerships to perform and sing their own music, right? You were either a kind of backroom songwriter like Lieber and Stoller, or you were a performer like Elvis. And there were definitely exceptions to that, you know, like Buddy Holly. But there wasn't a kind of songwriting partnership and performing kind of thing going on until they came along. And that's really important because I think what people could hear when they started having hits was the incredible honesty and authenticity of the singing and the sound, And it, because these songs were from them, right? And you can kind of hear the emotions that they're pouring into these songs in their voices.
How did they collaborate? I mean, to your knowledge, would Paul sit down and, I mean, because I know when he wrote Yesterday, which he originally called Scrambled Eggs, he had this thing in his head. Now, that was a McCartney song. But when they worked together on so many things, did one of them say, hey, I've got this tune, I've got these lyrics, and it was just a back and forth thing?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a few songs where you could say there's kind of true 50-50 collaborations where the songs just seem to emerge by osmosis between them, kind of sitting with each other and strumming guitars until something happens. But most of the time, even right from the early days, one of them would bring an idea to the other, right? And that idea might be, a fully worked out song, which the other then tweaks and kind of revises, or it might be a scrap of a song. Like I've got a chorus here, I've got a kind of tune in my head, and the other one says, "Okay, that's cool. What about if you do this for the verse? Or here's a middle eight, right?" I mean, Paul in particular was a master of saying, "You've got a great verse and chorus. Here's an incredible middle eight, right? Boom, boom, boom," and then suddenly you have this. Within a few minutes, you have an amazing pop song. So yeah, and so usually there's a Paul song and a John song, but almost always the other adds something and changes something. And even when the songs are written separately, the one of them's thinking about what the other's going to say, so they almost incorporate the other. So I see them really all the way through, right to the end of the Beatles' career, as writing together, even when they were writing apart.
I thought it was fascinating too. You mentioned that 159 of the 184 Beatles songs, hard to believe this was a 7-year, joint effort here. It seems like forever. But you when even though Ringo wrote some, George wrote some, but you talk about the sophistication of Paul and John's songs, that George and Ringo seem to be more simplistic in what they did, and that even some of the simple songs, She Loves You, are more complex than people recognized.
Oh yeah, I mean, and I did want to bring that out. Sometimes people say, "Oh, well, I like the Beatles, but I like their later stuff when they're really kind of sophisticated and edgy and innovative, because the poppy stuff just doesn't do it for me." Go back to that poppy stuff and listen to it again, and think about how innovative a song like "She Loves You" is. Nobody had thought of this idea of having a love triangle where I'm not in the relationship, but I'm singing. So you and this girl need to be together. That's a real friend to friend song, and so it's a real John and Paul song in that sense. It comes out of a friendship between two guys where they can speak about love and they can speak about vulnerabilities. Lyrically it's innovative, but also musically. They come in with the chorus, bam, blows you off your feet. And then on each chord of those years, on each of those years, there's a different chord, right? So you it's almost like they're spotlighting this very simple word, yeah, from three different directions. And then they kind of take you down to this, this jazzy kind of Glenn Miller chord. So it's rock and roll, it's girl groups, it's Glenn Miller, it's all smashed together. That's just the first sort of 15 seconds. So it's an incredible song.
One of the things that captivated me, Ian, is you talk about how when they're playing, I kind of always knew this, but I didn't really pay attention to it. John and Paul are always sort of looking at each other. They're sharing a mic. They're looking at each other. That wasn't typical of what a band, the band is connecting with the audience and whatever, and it always looks like John and Paul want to connect with each other. Talk about that dynamic.
Yeah, and that dynamic really is rooted in their coming together as teenagers when they start to write songs. As John puts it more than once in interviews, eyeball to eyeball, right? So they're sort of sitting across from each other with guitars in each other's bedrooms or in the front parlor of one of their houses in Liverpool. And they're writing songs, right, which nobody else was doing at the time. Very few, even teenagers who were into rock and roll, were not writing songs, right? So they managed to kind of make each other brave enough to start writing as well as playing songs. They're also becoming vulnerable to each other. You know what it's like when you show somebody a poem or a song for the first time? It's a nerve-wracking experience, right? Because you're kind of showing them something that's quite personal. Well, these guys were doing it from since they met, right? So they learned how to be vulnerable to each other, how to communicate with each other, emotionally through songs right from when they were teenagers. And that channel of communication goes right through the relationship, certainly when they were playing together in the Beatles. And you can can see it. You can see the eye contact is still there, you know, when they're on stage. And indeed, you can see it right at the end of the Beatles' career in these in the Get Back documentary when they're kind of recording these new songs. They're locked into each other, or they're just sort of glancing at each other, saying, what's John feeling about this? What's Paul feeling about this? And so, yeah, I think that kind of that strong connection between them, we can see it through what's going on with the eyes, but it's a real kind of telepathic connection that kind of goes all the way through their relationship.
To illustrate the detail with which this book is written, I have to tell you. So my brother is a Beatles fanatic. Rick, just his kids were raised on it, whatever. That's all there is Beatles. And I have a cousin, Marty. And Rick and Marty spend 24 hours a day discussing the Beatles. They bought your book the second it came out, did not know I was going to talk to you. But when they found out, they said, oh, we caught a mistake. And so maybe you can ask him. Let's go for it. So in the book, there's a chapter, of course, everyone's a book as a song title called I Am the Walrus, chapter 22. And on page 215, you talk about the song All You Need Is Love. And there's a famous moment in this song where towards the end, you hear a Beatle singing She Loves You, kind of an interesting moment in that song. Well, in the book, you write that it was John. And my brother and my cousin call me and they go, it's not, it's Paul. He said, John, we got him. Ian, here's your chance for two Beatles fanatics to clear it up. Are they right, or can you teach them something?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if they're right or wrong, because I'm not 100% sure, and I don't think anybody can be, which is one of the fascinating things about it. Yeah, so towards the end of the song, somebody goes, she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, it's either John and John or Paul. It sounds, and I get them, even now, I can't remember which one I said it was, because I get them mixed up.
You said John.
I said John, okay. But if you look, so some people think it's Paul, because it does sound kind of like Paul. But if you look at the footage, you can actually see it looks like it's John. So, and when I kind of looked at the footage, you get like, you know, 28 times in a row, it looked to me, it's not clear, but it looks to me more like John. You know, and I'm less interested in whether or not I'm 100% right. You know, I think it's probably.
I want to go there because whether it was John or Paul, from your perspective, the dynamic doesn't matter.
It kind of doesn't matter. And what's interesting to me about it is how they could sort of merge like that. They were so close. Sometimes John sounds very like John in his singing. Sometimes Paul sounds incredibly Paul. But sometimes they sound exactly like each other. So it's like they could kind of come together when they want and to kind of impersonate the other. It's this very kind of mystical, strange, spiritual connection, I think, that you can hear in the voices. There's another example on Sgt. Pepper, in the middle of a day in the life. You know, there's that kind of like, and people have argued, and they still argue, you know, in Reddit and on social media and in books, you know, who is that? Who's doing that? Is that John or Paul? And again, like, I don't know. It could be either, because it's one of those moments where they kind of merge.
Does anybody ever ask Paul?
I don't know, but I don't think Paul would remember, to be honest. It's nearly 60 years ago, and, you know, they were probably, you know, doing marijuana. And so I might not remember a lot.
Yeah. Talk for just a moment. The influence of people like George Martin, who, you know, a manager who worked with them, but he introduced, you write about this, like strings into certain songs and whatever. To what extent was the sound of the Beatles enhanced or maybe inhibited by the efforts of others like a George Martin who entered into their sound?
Oh, massively enhanced by George Martin. No question. Martin was this amazing combination of having incredible musical sophistication and talent and a great kind of like composer and arranger in his own right, and being humble enough to put his ego to one side pretty shortly after he meets these guys and go, do you know what? These chaps are really, really, really good, musically sophisticated. They may not be musically educated, but he recognized that they were musically sophisticated very early on. Other producers would not have recognized that, because they would have been, you know, I want to be the big shot. Here's how we do it, guys. It's my way or the highway. And George Martin, you know, this real gentleman, was smart enough and wise enough to go, oh, okay, no, I should let these guys basically do what they want to do and I'll help where I can. And when he did help, it was with perfect taste and perfect judgment. And some of his string arrangements, like on Eleanor Rigby, you know, it's incredible string arrangement that he does for that song. And but there, he makes wonderful touches all the way through the work of the Beatles.
Something else, again, we kind of know, but I didn't really think about it until you pointed out, there's no front man in this group. I mean, you know, Rolling Stones, it's Mick Jagger, whatever, you point to any band, you can point at Peter Noon, Herman's Hermits. And you come to this band, and you're right, you make the point, they actually don't have a front. Everybody says John and Paul, they have their moments. Was it a decision to not have a front man?
Yeah, it was actually. You know, when they were coming up, you know, before they were famous, they had real trouble explaining what they were to promoters and to record labels, because at that time, when they were trying to make it big, they were basically solo acts, or there was a front man and a group, right? So you could be Elvis Presley, or you could be Buddy Holly and the Crickets, or Cliff Richard and the Shadows, but there was always a front man, right? And John and Paul refused that. They didn't want either of them, you know, to be step out and sort of so you know, that's the kind of a fundamental decision early on that really kind of changed the shape of the group and then changed the face of rock music.
When they break up, you also write that so many of their songs are actually directed at each other, that if you don't know it, you hear it to be writing about whatever they're singing about, but you say no, actually they're taking jabs at each other. So a lot of bitterness after the breakup as well.
Yeah, I mean, the bitterness
with love,
is pretty
love
well
remains.
Known. Yeah, and I mean, How Do You Sleep, which is this kind of vicious attack from John to Paul on his second solo album, is a kind of full-on frontal, you know, attack. Now, that's well known about. I mean, what's less kind of recognised is that they were also writing songs of affection and love. And you know, these guys, let's go back to what we were saying earlier. They meet as teenagers. They learn to put their feelings, including their feelings about each other, into the songs, right? So inevitably, they communicate throughout the Beatles' career and afterwards in songs, better than they do in words. They're not actually great about expressing their feelings for each other, verbalizing them, but they do put their feelings into the music, and you can hear it in the Beatles. You can also hear it in the 70s after the Beatles have broken up, when they're not talking to each other at all, or not much, you know. And so where they put their most powerful feelings about each other, like Let Me Roll It by Paul McCartney and Wings, 1973, it's very much a kind of John Lennon style song, and it seems to be a real kind of expression of kind of love for John, the kind of thing that he wasn't able to say because their relationship had got really difficult. And there are other examples, you know, right through to Just Like Starting Over, John's last sort of hit single before he dies, which I think is kind of full of like little hints towards Paul that, you know, we're still friends and maybe we can get together again.
Just a moment.
So, you know, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, just a moment left. 50 years from now, will people be talking about the Beatles, about Paul McCartney, about John Lennon, or all of them?
Oh, all of them, no question. I think the Beatles will last as long as you know, Shakespeare has lasted. I think if we're talking about anything in 500 years' time from the last 50 years, it'll be the Beatles.
And actually, lastly, will we ever see another Beatles, Paul and John combo again? I mean, do you see it anywhere today?
No, I think, just to use the Shakespeare comparison again, that's sort of apt. You know, Shakespeare was a kind of freak. There were other brilliant playwrights around, Marlowe and Jonson and so on. We still perform their plays hundreds of years later. So they've done incredibly well, right? But Shakespeare's on a different plane. And that's the way I feel about the Beatles and all the other groups and singers that I love from the 60s and afterwards. I just think there's something kind of incredible and freakishly amazing about them that I think kind of transcends everything else.
Ian Leslie, the book is John and Paul, A Love Story and Songs. Just amazing. I so loved it, as did my family. So thank you so much for your time and for writing this book. And I wish you great success. Bestseller.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. And thanks for watching us here on Paul Lisnett Behind the Curtain. We'll see you next week.